Hey yo, hey yo, what's up, what's up? This is Eric Torenberg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's episode is with Matt Mullenweg. Matt, the founder of WordPress, is one of the humblest guys around. When I think of people I admire or want to be like, Matt comes instantly to mind. He's very thoughtful, smart, successful, has a very small ego, and doesn't do any dumb shit that other people I admire did. That said, I'm not big on role models recently, as the more and more you get to know people, and in fact, the past couple years I've got to know a lot of people I thought were role models and know them well, you always find something that is a little off. And in the beginning you get to become disappointed, but then you realize that people are just people, and it's better to take bits and pieces of things that you admire and try to emulate them. But if you put someone on a pedestal, there's always going to be a little bit of disappointment. And idolizing also, it doesn't seem like super healthy. Like, focus on yourself. Anyways, not to have a PSA about role models, this podcast episode with Matt, who is awesome, is about a lot of things. Daily rituals, how he started WordPress, how being a successful CEO early on has affected his relationships, his family, how he thinks about hiring, investing, and evaluating people, and it was a fun one. All right, here's Matt. Matt, thank you for joining and taking the time to chat with us today.
Of course.
First question, what is most on your mind right now? What's something you're grappling with? What's something you're thinking about? What's top of mind for you?
So in just a few days, I'm going to what we call the Grand Meetup, which is the once a year, Automatic is a distributed company, but once a year, we bring everybody together in one place. There's going to be about 400 people there, about a third of which I've never even met before. So I am, that's just a couple of days away. And it's sort of a mixture of emotions. It's like thinking about the planning and the products and the, some people are teaching classes, some people are doing like a hack week. And it's also like anxious, like the first day of school, like, will I sit at the cool kids table, it's a real interesting mix of emotions. And actually talking to people is kind of funny because people like get haircuts beforehand, they plan out their outfits, just like school.
It's kind of like a festival for you guys.
Yeah.
So cool kids table in school is an interesting way to start off because I want to start by kind of exploring your backstory a bit. And you got into, this when you were very young. Did you start WordPress when you were, under 20?
I was 19.
19. I'm curious when someone, gets into something, and I know you've thought about this, when someone gets into something at such a young age, at such a serious, such a serious venture, how do you kind of make sense of that looking back, you getting into this so young? Do you feel that there were some serious things you missed that you tried to make up for later in life? Do you feel like certain experience, other people are going off in college, partying, doing this and that? How do you kind of make sense of this looking back?
I definitely miss kind of the college party thing, but as an office space, I wouldn't say I missed it, Bob, it was one of those things that...
you turned out okay.
Well, also, as an adult, I think partying is a little more fun than as a college guy, although maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I never did it. But what I do today is in many ways very similar to what I did then, just with a little more of the people side and less of the code side. So the things that being so early, there was definitely ageism, that I encountered, and a lot of people who don't take you seriously because you're young. And then the main thing is just experience, especially on the leadership side. I think that there's so much you learn about being a lead or an executive or a CEO or a coach just by doing it. And so the sort of 10 years of experience thus far definitely was a great preparation. And part of why I wasn't hired a CEO fairly early on. So Tony Schneider joined, I don't remember exactly when, but it was definitely the first 6 months. So essentially at the beginning of the company. And was the CEO for 7 or 8 years. And during that time, I learned a ton just watching him in action.
When you talk to other 18-year-olds who you see, or younger people who you see a little bit of yourself in them, do you recommend them the same path, you know, starting a company right away? Do you tell them that they should go to college or work somewhere else? What common advice do you find yourself giving?
You know, I don't think there's any one right way or right path. There's certainly lots of examples of entrepreneurs who went to college or entrepreneurs who started things in their 30s or 40s. So while there's, I think we kind of tell ourselves as a pattern and then we look for confirmation bias of that, like, oh, college dropouts make billion-dollar companies or something. But you know what? There's hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of college dropouts every year. And so if you just look at the data, it's probably not a causal effect.
You know, you asked in one of the AMAs in Tracy Chow's live chat with us, if she was teaching a course of women, which you know she had 30 minutes, what she would teach. I'm curious what you think about college more broadly. Do you think it's so far away from a learning experience that your kids are going to have in the future? Do you think college is going to change massively, not just the how much it costs, but also the way it's taught? What are your thoughts on that?
I certainly hope so. Now, there's some of the best institutions in the world. Like, I think Tracy went to Stanford, et cetera. Like, when I visit those campuses or talk at them, I'm like, wow, I totally would not have dropped out if I came here. It's beautiful. It's awesome. But I think the vast majority of folks are not getting the most amazing educational opportunities at their higher education institute of choice. And you could argue neither are they getting it at their high school or middle school or elementary school level. But when you think about how technology can personalize an experience, a lot of it taking what we've learned from games and applying it to education. And there's far smarter people than I working on this, but the idea of a game is you're always at the edge of your competency, right? Because you want it to be just hard enough to keep you in flow, but not so hard that you give up. And that's also, it turns out, the best state for learning anything. And learning is fun, like we've all had the experience where like you couldn't do something and then you did something. And maybe we think about it in the context of skiing or kitesurfing or some other like physical thing. But it's just as true, like maybe the first time you refactor a polynomial equation or something, like that can have the same sort of boost. And so I think that we can make learning a lot more fun and more importantly, more personalized than it is today. And then every single student in America or in the world could learn from whoever is like the Michael Jordan of teaching algebra. There's no reason that we should expect every teacher to be amazing at everything. Like let the sort of online or virtual experience be the best person in the world at teaching it. And then have the in-person folks focus on everything else that they can do to sort of facilitate the learning process, including helping people that are stuck.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully we're going to see some, and we're already starting to see a lot, but even more entrepreneurs, do very bold things in K-12, but also on the university level. Is there anything you've seen that's really excited you?
I visited up in University of Washington that was doing sort of exactly what I just said, which is applying game design techniques to learning. And they've, now the names are completely escaping me at the moment, so terrible answer, but check out the UW stuff.
Cool. And so going back to, you're 19, you started WordPress, you're in Texas?
Yes.
And so how does it grow from here? Do you get discovered by Tony Conrad at this point? Tell us a little bit of the backstory about how WordPress, takes off in the beginning.
Sure. So WordPress started as an open source project. And built on both the code base and the community of a prior open source project that had been temporarily abandoned called B2. So the initial users and developers and everything were just all folks who knew each other online. I don't think any of us had met before. And the co-founder of WordPress was a fellow named Mike Little, who was based in the UK, and who I wouldn't meet for another probably 2 or 3 years in person. The original discoveries, it was kind of picked up by bloggers, and MovileType was the dominant blogging system at the time. And so, but they were having a lot of problems with spam and scaling. And so I would actually comment on people's blogs. I guess you could call it spam now, but I would leave personalized comments on people's blogs whenever they're having trouble offering to help. I ended up doing web hosting for a bunch of prominent web developers, just because I was good at running servers and could put them on a a nice experience. And so just kind of reaching out in every way possible. Probably the first person in the valley to really notice and discover it, besides, of course, our competitors at Six Apart, would have been O'Malik, actually, the journalist, who at the time was, I think, a Business 2.0. And I don't remember if there was this guy, Tantek Celik, who was just leaving Microsoft. He had been a browser developer at Microsoft and was about to leave, I believe, to go to Technorati. And I actually stayed at his place, crashed at his place for a week during the summer, kind of when I was 20, and just fell in love with San Francisco and everything about it. And the people were so cool, and it was like I found my tribe, like everyone who was passionate about the same things I was passionate about, which at the time was like web standards and economics and, you know, programming. So I don't remember if I met Ohm then or later, but he was the connection to both Tony Conrad and Tony Schneider. Tony Schneider had just sold a company to Yahoo called Oddpost, which was kind of Gmail before Gmail. It was the first Ajaxy email client. And Ohm did a cover story on them called, I don't remember, but the Oddpost guys were all on the cover of the magazine in like a cool old car. And it was kind of like that Kevin Rose story in Business Week. Like, they went from nothing to $50 million in 12 months. I think it was called Insta Company. It was different that they actually sold the company to Yahoo. But Ohm, I think, said to Tony, he was like, you know, this Yahoo thing. And Yahoo was cool at the time. So you have to imagine that Yahoo is one of the coolest places and you want to sell your company to them. He told Tony, like, you know, good job, and Tony had this cool job at Yahoo. Like, but you're not going to last here. There's this kid out of Houston you got to meet, and let me introduce you to him. And that was my connection to both Tony Schneider, who later became CEO, and Tony Conrad, who became our independent board member.
And you're good friends, you know, a decade later.
Very, very close with everyone, yeah. So, that, in fact, that entire group, it was Phil Black from what was before True, but Phil Black was sort of wrote the first check in Automatic. Tony Conrad gave incredible advice and connections to folks. O'Malik as well. Tony Schneider and myself, like, we're all still good friends. And actually, 4 out of 5 of us, everyone that's at me, is now a partner at True Ventures.
Wow. I'm curious, what are your kind of, you know, litmus tests for people that you want in your tribe or not? Especially as you've had, you know, similar friends for a long time, but, you know, you meet new people all the time as well. How do you think about that?
I guess I don't think about it a ton. I'm very open-minded. Like, you know, so I'm always trying to learn from everyone I meet or, you know, see the best in people. And for who I end up spending most time with, which is sort of a function of who you become closest with, I don't know. I guess it's overlap in interest. And definitely in terms of people who, you know, I want to spend lots of time with, I can definitely look for people who just have like a good soul, a good spirit. But to be honest, that's a lot of the people who you meet, especially in San Francisco, who work in this industry. Like, there's definitely, you know, carpetbaggers and folks, but the vast majority are really passionate about technology and helping people and helping the world. Certainly everyone listening to this podcast. So there's lots of fantastic folks who I don't get to spend that much time about. And that actually stresses me way more because there's so many amazing people. Like, I'll name one, Ryan Sarver, one of my favorite people in the world. I just don't get to see him that often. So, Ryan Sarver, Tom Conrad, ton of cool folks.
Yeah, is it because you live a nomadic life?
That's totally my fault. Yeah, it's not them at all. It's because, I am on the road the vast majority of the time. I think I was 425 or 450,000 miles last year. And so that can be a little bit of a bummer. It's honestly, it's fantastic that I get to see people periodically in different places. Actually, sometimes friends in San Francisco I'm more likely to hang out with someplace else.
Like South by Southwest or something.
Yeah.
How do you keep grounded, you know, when you're traveling to different places? Or, you know, what roots you?
I don't know. Maybe I'm bad at perceiving when I'm not grounded. So it's just, I try to have daily routines, and I work every day, so I think work is very good at grounding you because, you know, the stuff that needs to get done.
Yeah. So your routines, you meditate, you read. How would you describe your routines?
Yeah, I like to do sun salutations in the morning. I try to do at least a couple push-ups and squats. I have a sort of a tiny habit I'm working on there. I run at least once a week and hopefully, you know, two or three times a week. What else? Meditate for 10 minutes using the Calm app, which I'm also an investor in. I think those are the main things. I've been using this new thing called coach.me, which I think used to be called Lyft. They also write the best updates, like the update notes on the App Store. They're the best in the entire world. So, and it's just kind of nice because I was trying to use Wunderlist for this, and it was very frustrating. But just kind of like that you have things that you check off or sort of daily recurring things that are aspirational, it's a really nice app for that.
You know, sometimes when I find, you know, people who are, who've been very successful but also have sort of a calm at-peaceness to them, which I put you in that category, sometimes in their past, I've noticed a trend that they used to have a lot of anger or a lot of, like a chip on their shoulder, a lot of energy that they found a really great way to channel it. Is that true in your case, or have you kind of always been a calm killer, so to say, you know, a calm but someone who works really hard?
I would say that the things that frustrate me or get me angry are just always product related. It's not like a people thing. I just feel like
people don't frustrate you? They're the worst.
I know, they're so non-deterministic. But no. I try to channel all my frustrations just into trying to make products better, especially our own.
Yeah, you mentioned in the AMA that you would have, you know, what you would tell your 25-year-old self is to spend less time in IRC arguments and online kind of discussions or flame wars. Did you find yourself losing your cool online a little bit?
Oh, you know what? That's kind of the nature of open source in a lot of ways. That especially early on, when I was both leading and coding a lot of the major changes and everything, open source tends to be an argumentative process. It's actually one of the downsides that I think drives a lot of people away from contributing. And just as typical with online discussions, I'm sure it happens on Product Hunt too, without, you know, all the awesome moderation you do, is that they tend to be dominated by the people who have the most time to participate in them, which isn't always a Venn diagram overlap with the people who have the most to say or the most to do with it. So that's just something I keep in mind. And although I don't do that personally as much anymore, there's a lot of great people in the community who perhaps both because of their position are a little less prominent. And so people don't engage them just because they're like the head person. And you know, some more grace and patience with how they communicate.
Yeah. You mentioned that your life, you know, at 19 is pretty similar in some ways to what it is now, you know, 12 years later in terms of function, you know, being CEO of a company. How, you know, if you were 19, you were CEO, you were, you know, traveling a lot, did that impact your ability to have relationships at that age? You know, being so ahead professionally, but, you know, just being a 19-year-old, obviously, you know, you were different than your peers who were that age. How did that affect your relationships going into your early 20s?
Say early days, I traveled a lot less, partly because I just didn't have any money. So I tend to be a lot more San Francisco. And relationship-wise, I think I just ended up dating older people. You know, my girlfriend in San Francisco at the time, I think, was 28 or 29 when I was 20, 21. So maybe I was a little more mature, she was a little less mature, we met in the middle, I don't know. But you sort of ended up engaging more at that level. A lot of my friends and everything were older.
Was ageism something you thought a lot about? I mean, do you always try to give young people, you know, an extra chance now if you find yourself discounting them? Or how do you think about that?
Yeah, to me, it's one of those things that's completely orthogonal from why you should or shouldn't engage with someone. So I don't really think about it too much in terms of what I would run into. There was a little bit definitely on the funding side, but I tried to think of that as a good filter for someone who might not be a good partner or investor long term. You know, if they're not going to take you seriously because you're young, well, thank goodness that you figured it out early and not like 2 or 3 years down the line when there's some other problem. Where it would frustrate me the most was just in like almost like in retail. Like I remember really distinctly, like kind of 18-ish, I saved up money to buy like a digital camera. And I went to Best Buy and I couldn't get anyone to like help me, you know? And just things like that are more those sort of snap interactions where people judge you more by your appearance, especially when you're buying something or trying to interact with something. I think that in actual relationships where you have a conversation with someone or you work with someone, you know, people pretty quickly figure out what level you're at and that you can engage or not with them at the same level.
Yeah, I find myself, for whatever reason, having friends who are dating people who are a lot younger or who are a lot older. For whatever reason, there's a balance there. What in terms of people you enjoy spending time with, you mentioned you look for work ethic, taste, integrity, curiosity. I'm really curious how curiosity, work ethic, you can get a sense of. I'm curious how you measure people's or think about people's sense of taste and how you discover where they if they have integrity or not.
Those are very good questions. Taste is probably a lot easier because it often manifests itself or exhibits itself in everything that someone does. Integrity, I don't know if I know the perfect or a good objective way to ascertain that. And it might be something that you sort of learn about someone over time, you know, perhaps even over years of working together. I think it was my mom who, I'm sure someone else said it, but integrity is what you do when no one else is watching, right? And so you sort of see that down the line. For taste, you know, I look at how people write their emails, how they communicate, if they have any social media, how do they present themselves there? How is their code organized? How is their code formatted? Is it commented? All these sorts of things. I think that, and by the way, it has nothing to do with that, like having a great design or something. It's more about thoughtfulness. You know, do you think about how whoever the audience is for whatever you put into the world, whether that's an email to a single person, or that's a project that you led or published, whether it's a company that you had. You know, we have lots of people at Automatic that used to be either freelancers or be founders of things. So how is that presented? And did you really think about every aspect of it? And to me, people who are thoughtful in one area tend to be thoughtful in other areas. And so that taste is definitely something that is difficult to teach, maybe impossible. Just like a Bill Bradley or someone would be like, you can't coach tall. Oh, no, that was the basketball guy who said that. So I totally attributed that wrong. But, you know, there's some things that might be more intrinsic and that people either have them, they learned them as part of the upbringing, or not. And you're probably within the sort of realm that you engage someone professionally as an employer, not going to be able to change that.
You mentioned in the AMA and Product Hunt that one of the things that sets you apart is your ability to hire great people. And you've thought a lot about this. What do you think you uniquely or your team uniquely understands about hiring or is very good at that other people just haven't figured out yet to the same level?
So it works on, I think, three levels. First and foremost, what matters the most is that we've created a place where great people want to be. And that's how the company is structured. It's how we work together. It's how we communicate. It's all these sorts of things. It's the fact that it's distributed and you could travel.
Flexibility.
Yeah, flexibility, trust, autonomy. Like, these are things that, I mean, great people can work anywhere they want in the world. It's true. So how do you create something that is someplace that people want to be, given they have an infinite number of choices? Two, I would say, you know, telling people about it. A lot of the press we do or outreach, or if you go to automatic.com, like, it's all basically a funnel to our Work With Us page. And we try to exhibit to things that we look for, taste, integrity, work ethic, and everything that we do. So people who have the same qualities want to be surrounded by other folks like that. So we try to make everything that we do tasteful and well-designed. And, you know, how we've interacted with the open source community now. When Automatic started, people were very nervous about a company, for-profit company, led by the project lead, also doing commercial stuff. And be honest, like, they were right to distrust us, because most examples of companies coming out of open source, usually the open source project suffers a lot. But now it's been a decade, and 10 years later, we can point to, you know, a long history of acting with integrity in the best interest of both sides. And then finally, in our hiring process, we try to not be too precious or get too caught up in anything that strays from first principles of why we want to work with someone. So that's why we do the trial process, where we actually work alongside people. It's why, you know, years before Google did, we abandoned all the logic puzzles and things like that, because we just saw no connection. And so we try to be very honest with ourselves and open to changing how we approach things in our hiring process. And one of the things I'm very proud of for everyone at Automattic who works on hiring, which is, you know, a couple dozen people at this point. Actually, I can look and see the exact number. We have 20 people who are working on hiring right now. So about 5% of the company. You know, they really think of it like a craft, and they think of it in terms of how do we get the best possible outcome, which also includes, you know, it doesn't end at the hire. It's about onboarding and training. And also when someone doesn't work out, like what we go back and look at the transcripts, look at the hiring recommendation, look at everything that led up to that person being hired and say, well, what can we learn from this? What should we do differently in the future?
Are you going to write a book about this?
No, because it's always changing. At any point that the book started or was frozen in time, probably by the time it was published, I would be unhappy with it. So this is why I'm happy to do interviews or podcasts or blog posts.
Yeah.
But advice that is not time-stamped, I just get embarrassed about.
Right, and let the other person, let everybody else put the book together over time with a collection of, you know, a kind of an evolving one. Interesting. What, you know, in another piece in the live chat, you mentioned to your 20-year-old self, you would say that you know, you would tell yourself to have more patience, that you that there will be a lot more decades where you can do, you know, a lot more things that you really want to exist in the world. Were there some things that you rushed too quickly, and what are some of the, you know, big things that you feel that you need to do that you won't feel complete if you don't do them?
I'd say one mistake that we made early on at Automattic, and, you know, probably still make to an extent today, is just having kind of too many irons in the fire at any given time. I mean, at the point when we were like 20, 25 people, we had like 5 products, you know, different things we were doing. And so we were all spread pretty thin. And yeah, I think the patience aspect might also be related to focus. So just being okay. I mean, there's still, honestly, I still want to loop back to some of those things. You know, we just took on e-commerce this year with the acquisition of WooCommerce. You know, this is an area that I wanted to work on for the better part of a decade. And we're just now have the organizational capacity and through an acquisition able to really tackle it. And I'm excited about what's going to come out of that the next 5-10 years as we sort of try to build up WooCommerce the same way we've built up WordPress.
Yeah, there's this famous E.B. White quote, you may know it. It's, I rise in the morning torn between a desire to improve the world and desire to enjoy the world, or save the world, or savor the world. This makes it hard for me to plan my day.
Hmm. And I also love what Sam Altman said, where, I don't know if this is from him, or but it was the title of a blog post, the days are long, but the decades are short.
Yeah. What does that make you think? Tell me more about that.
You know, if I'm lucky, I feel like I do have many productive decades in front of me. And I think turning 30 was a point to look back on that, because really since, well, 19, I had been in the thick of it and very lucky to be involved with an extremely successful project, you know, one that was having an impact on the web as a whole. So kind of 10 years into that, there's no signs of slowing down. And in fact, there's a lot more opportunities than I've ever been there before. And I think that just, I don't know. I think I always aspired and really wanted to work on things that lasted a long time when I was younger. Kind of this romantic notion. The same one we have at Automattic. Like, we think of life employment as a lifetime thing. Like, I'm not expecting whatever Reid Hoffman tours of duty where everyone's here for 2 years and then go someplace else. Like, I really think of people as, when they join Automattic, as being here for decades to come. That's why we try to treat people like they will be. And so now having working on things that continue to be successful for that long, it gives me more confidence that maybe when I'm 40, I can start something new that I could still work on when I'm 60 or 70.
What would you start?
You know, we'll see, because I expect the world to be very, very, very different by the time I'm 40. And I hope that as new platforms open up, whether that's, you know, virtual reality platforms or whatever it is, you know, billions more people have ubiquitous broadband, you know, what that can enable.
Do you see yourself, you know, you've been running this for a decade. Do you see yourself potentially adopting the Alphabet model?
We were kind of Alphabet before Alphabet. I mean,
yeah, right. Automatic WordPress is one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. So automatic, you know, if you go to the automatic.com homepage, it shows you the different things that we're involved in. And there's no reason, I would say the main thing I expect to change as we grow to be, you know, from 400 today to be maybe 4,000 in the future, it's just that we'll be able to put a lot more resources behind each of those areas. Something like SimpleNote, which, you know, we work on a little bit periodically right now. Actually, SimpleNote just had some awesome updates, so check it out if you haven't recently. I would love to have a team of 20 or 30 people that just worked full-time on SimpleNote and just imagined everything that could happen with that platform. And by the way, the technology behind SimpleNote is the reason we bought the company. It's called Simperium, and it's this really, really, really cool synchronization technology. I want to have the time to open source that. You know, it's been on the list for a long time. It's great tech. We use it at WordPress.com scale now on billions of pages. So we know that it's a good thing for the world. We just have to find the time to do the work to put it out there.
Yeah. You also have Audrey Capital, which is over 50 investments, quite a few.
Yeah, I think 65 or 70 now.
Yeah.
And they're not all on the site. Some are still stealth.
Yeah. I presume you're going to continue to do and grow that. Are there other kind of side projects, whether they're creative pursuits or, you know, I know you're big into rap and music as well as I am. You know, is there something you want to do there?
I recently did pick up the saxophone again and started practicing. Actually, because we're going to do a performance at the Grand Meetup, like a bunch of people who play different things. So that's been kind of fun, actually, a lot of fun. And the cool thing about the structure of Automatic, that if I ever wanted to do a side project, it would be under Automatic. Like, there's no reason to start anything else. The Audrey stuff, which is separate from Automatic, is just that way because, you know, Automatic doesn't really do investments in the same way. And it's also very much a very small percent of my time. It's more, for me, a way to give back to entrepreneurs. Just like I had so much help and advice from Om, Tony, Phil, like all these people that I met and when I moved to San Francisco and before I moved to San Francisco. Those connections, I just kind of want to pay it forward and help other entrepreneurs. I don't really think about it like a financial return thing.
Quit on the financial return thing. Do you not think about it that way, but does it do well for you? I mean, would you advise other people if they wanted to make, you know, who had your type of access to great entrepreneurs that they should spend their money investing? Or do you kind of think of it as a donation?
Well, I don't think it would be fair to the entrepreneurs if I thought of it purely as a donation. So I definitely make every investment thinking that the company could be a much more substantial interest than it currently is, and that what they're making should exist in the world. That said, I just maintain for my own personal self the no expectation of any return. I kind of assume every investment goes to zero, just because I think that's a good mentality. That allows me to help the entrepreneur just for them without being concerned about, you know, the money that I had invested in them, which maybe means I might give them different advice. So because I effectively discount that to zero from the day the investment is made, it allows me to be somewhat detached and unemotional or undriven by the cash when dealing with the entrepreneur, which I think is the best thing for them. It's more like you might think of an advisor than necessarily an investor. And also the amounts are so small relative to the total amounts they raise, you know, that they shouldn't think of me as an investor in that way.
Yeah. You mentioned Reid Hoffman. There was just a New Yorker profile of him that, you know, just came out. And one of the things it mentioned was that he doesn't have any kids. Do you want kids?
Yeah, I definitely do want kids someday. And I have to check out this Reid Hoffman profile. Like, he's one of my favorite people in the world, so I love to read that. But I would love to build a family someday. There's nothing on the road, nothing to announce here in that regards. But and it's definitely something I don't feel like I'm ready for yet, just in terms of the responsibility of teaching and growing another human being. But someday, absolutely.
Yeah, there was a separate piece. Jonathan Franzen, the novelist, was thinking about having kids, and someone told him, his editor at The New Yorker told him that not many people can write, you know, novels the way you do. A lot more people can be really good fathers. Not to put down being a good father, but he's a top novelist. And he took that to heart and decided not to have kids. Have you ever thought about it in that context, that you are, you know, uniquely, and of course these aren't mutually exclusive at any way, right? But has there ever been a side of you that says, hey, you know, I'm already plenty busy right now and have, you know, motivations that are very high ambitions, that might not be the best thing? Or is something you actively wanted? How do you thought about that?
I would say that I probably actively wanted less than when I was younger. So when I was younger, I was definitely like, I'm absolutely going to have kids. And actually around 30 might have been the time I was planning on it. I also wanted to retire at 30, which now seems like the silliest thing. Not that I could have retired at 25, but like, just that I can't imagine.
What else would you do?
Exactly. I'd want to do exactly what I'm doing today. So why retire? Like, I really love work. So now I think I'd be totally okay with either path. And of course, that's highly dependent on your partner, right? it's usually a two-person decision to do this. Although you can adopt and other things, but you know, I'm lucky. The folks who I've mentioned five times already, Ohm, Tony, and Phil, show both paths. You know, Ohm has no kids. Tony has three. Other Tony has two. Phil has three. So, you know, I've definitely seen both, where you can be a very successful executive and product person and builder at the same time as being a great father, what I consider all those men to be. And also the path where you cannot have any kids and still have like an incredibly rich life and friendships and relationships with folks. And in fact, actually what's taken a little bit of the pressure off, I actually have a lot of god kids. So I'm a godfather to a number of friends' children, about six right now. So I definitely get, they're all sort of under seven, under eight. So I spend a lot of time, as much time as I can with them and trying to spoil them. And so that removes a little bit of the sort of biological clock.
I just became an uncle, the first time uncle. So I feel that as well. Shout out to Natalie who's listening.
But it's totally not fair, because we're just getting the good part.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely not fair. One thing you mentioned, you could have retired at 30, you could have retired at 25. With you know, it's crazy the success that happened so quickly. How have you kept your kind of ego in check, or how have you been level-headed through this time? You know, what's gone through your head in that way?
Well, I suppose I have kept my ego in check, so thank you for that. But no, I think just, I might have answered this in the AMA, like, you know, I've had a very supportive set of family and friends, and part of that love is telling you when, you know, you're being silly, you know, and including when they're supporting you when you're down or need help. So I think just when you develop deep relationships with people, that can be part of what keeps you grounded or rooted, or doesn't let your ego get too big.
Yeah. You mentioned you admire Reid Hoffman. Why do you admire him?
Oh, man. Well, one, he's like made time for me at some different points over the past 10 years, you know, to take an hour or two and, you know, just talk. And he, you know, one of the things, I'm sure they talk about this in the article, he has a academic background, including in philosophy. And that's always been something I've been pretty fascinated about. And so he's like a 10x my knowledge there, because I think he studied this at some place like Oxford or something like that.
Yep, Oxford.
So he can kind of school me and teach me some things there, or point me in a direction of a book or something that I find really enlightening. And especially early on, kind of 8, 9, 10 years ago, I think encouraged me to go in the direction that's been very successful thus far, which is really thinking about things, trying to derive the first principles of what you, of every problem, whether that's business or HR or compensation or anything. So yeah, that's pretty helpful. And he's one of those people who I think is amazing that I would love to see more, but I don't get to see that often.
Right. You know, we talked about, you know, having kids. I want to talk about the other side of the coin in terms of being, you know, being a kid to your parents. At 19, you know, you became CEO. A lot of people who become very successful early on also, I find, are, you know, trying to prove something, or also a lot of people who don't become successful are trying to prove something and have a chip on their shoulder. Did you find yourself With a chip on your shoulder as a kid, did you, you know, did you leave home early? Were your parents super supportive? What was your relationship with your parents all throughout this?
Super good. I did leave home early, but I think that was just because I was like ready to get out into the world. And really just, you know, I was always inspired by each of my family members. Like my sister is an incredible writer, you know, which probably helped get me into blogging. Introduced me to a ton of really great music. And because she's 10 years older than me, like kind of probably might have been the reason I grew up a little bit faster. Because, you know, the closest person to you in the world, your sibling, was 10 years older. So when I was like an annoying 6 or 7 year old, she was, you know, coming out of, you know, junior or senior in high school. So she probably like gave me a hard time in ways that just made me more mature. With my mom, you know, she was always just kind of very creative and has this empathy. Like someone asked me the other day, we had so many pets growing up. Like there was turtles, rabbits, dogs, cats. Like it was like a little miniature zoo there. And she made so much happen with a relatively small amount of money. But just throughout it all, that sort of deep, deep empathy. Like, you know, she has these dogs now that are some sort of specialized dogs that she like cooks food for. And I was like, well, of course. I joked with my sister, like, you and me moved out. Like, she needs to take care of something. Now, the dogs probably eat better than we did when we were little. But and then finally, my dad is just probably a lot of my decisions have been driven by him. Just like when you're a kid, you want to be like your dad. And he played saxophone in high school, which is why I started playing saxophone. He, you know, is in the tech arena, which is part of why I wanted to learn computers. And he would work on cars, so I'd like learn about cars. And, you know, so all these sort of things were kind of like, I used to walk behind him with like a little toy lawnmower when he would mow the lawn, you know, just things like that.
Do you think you craved his love more than your mom's in terms of, you know, trying to be like them or prove to them something?
No, I would say, you know, my dad, like many men, is less demonstrative. Like he says it less, although that's changed as we both gotten older. But you definitely feel it from both of them and from my sister as well. So just these different things. His work ethic always really inspired me. You know, he would be up every morning, you know, six, seven, I don't remember how early, put on the suit and tie, get the briefcase. And he worked at energy companies like Halliburton, Brown & Root, etc. And just like, yeah, it would work really, really consistently and really hard. And then sometimes on weekends he'd work as well, and he'd take me into the office because there wouldn't be anyone else there. So I could kind of goof. He'd set me up on a computer, and I could goof around on their ultra-fast, like, T1 internet connection.
Yeah.
While he would do some extra work.
Cool. I have a series of rapid-fire questions. They don't need rapid-fire answers. What's something you used to fervently believe that you now see as misguided?
A lot around nutrition, actually.
Yeah? How so?
It's actually something I used to give my dad a hard time for because, you know, we'd go to breakfast and he'd get like a steak and eggs. And I'd be like, oh, that's the unhealthiest thing ever. And of course, knowing what we now know, what I now know, like that's actually a pretty good breakfast. You get some protein, you get some eggs. It's a very, very full thing. And so there's definitely a lot I've learned there. I don't know. I would say that fervent beliefs... That's the first thing that came to mind was nutrition. Sorry, I'm sure there's dozens or hundreds of others.
No, sure. Are you religious in any way?
I am. I'm Catholic.
Is that where you would say you find your, you know, your ethical roots or your sense of what's right and wrong?
Yeah, I think you can definitely pick up some of that. You know, going to church or reading the Bible. You know, Boy Scouts were super good influence when I was young. And then just family, you know, my grandmother, my parents. I think you learn a lot of that stuff. Again, kids are sponges. So you see, you know, thousands and thousands of interactions and little things that happen. And so like, you know, if you accidentally take a napkin from the restaurant, like we would drive back and give them back the napkin. You know, 'cause I would leave it like tucked in my shirt or something as a kid. You know, just little stuff like that. I feel like those million micro interactions are probably what help you learn. And also what is kind of terrifying about having kids, right? Because you're really, everything that you do, they're watching and learning from and then emulating.
When it's all said and done, whatever that means, what do you want your Wikipedia page to say?
that, you know, I helped the world publish. I think that would be a great legacy to leave, because when people publish and communicate, I feel that it brings us closer together.
Yeah. Do you have certain, you know, beyond that, do you have certain causes that you want to make a name, you know, actively support or like put a lot of resources behind? I know, you know, Make the World a Better Place to Publish is a great cause in and of itself. But just curious there.
Philanthropically, there's definitely a number of causes I try to support, ranging from the basic, like water, with something like a charity water, to things that enrich our soul, like the Bay Lights Project, which is, you know, purely artistic. But for what I'm working on myself, I would say Automattic, WordPress, and its products are very much my life's work, and where I feel like I'll probably have the biggest impact by working directly.
And what do you want people, you know, the alternative question to this is, what do you want people to say about you as a person? You know, what do you want people to say at your funeral?
Ooh, that he always threw a good party.
I like that. I like that. What would your 29-year-old self, you know, say about your 31-year-old self?
Oh, I think you'd be happy that I'm a lot healthier. I was actually just thinking this today. I went for a run in Houston, and it's kind of this morning, and it's kind of hot and muggy. And as my watch beeped to me that I passed mile 5, I was like, wow, it was just like 2 years ago when I was 29 that I kind of started doing this, and I couldn't even run a mile without walking part of it.
Now you're doing a marathon, right?
Well, it sets your body adapts, and I think that because it happens over time, like you sort of lose track of it. But it was really nice this morning to have, because I was so hot and miserable, but I was like, hey, I'm still running, and it's been 5 miles. Like, that's a good amount. I feel like if I was running from a bear or something, like, I could keep it up for a while. And I don't know. That's pretty useful. And that's something I'd also encourage folks to really think about who are listening, like that the sum of very small habits, like if I went out, and I think I did do this, like went out and tried to run several miles when I was just starting, you just hurt yourself. You know, you don't really actually benefit everything. But if you can do a little bit every day, man, does it add up.
And it seemed, you know, going back, that's the Sam Altman quote, the days are long, but the decades are short. You've seemed to adopt habits in terms of, you know, meditating, sand salutation, you know, yoga positions in the morning, reading. What is your biggest, you know, trick to starting a habit like that? Is it just a little bit, you know, start really small?
Yeah, and I think this comes from a Stanford professor called BJ Fogg. He talks about tiny habits. I want to say he even has a site. Let me look real quick, like tinyhabits.com. Tinyhabits.com. So he says three things will change behavior in the long term. Have an epiphany, change your environment, what surrounds you, or option C, take baby steps. You know, it's like when I started, I do push-ups every day now, I started just doing one.
Yeah. What's a bad habit you're trying to get rid of, or what's another habit you're trying to adopt?
Ooh, bad habits I would like to get rid of. There's so many. I would say probably the most persuasive right now is getting distracted by notifications. And especially if I look at it first thing in the morning, I can just get really drawn in. So I am currently at a struggle because, you know, so many apps, there's very smart people working on making these sort of notifications and interruptions very compelling, and including as part of my work. Like, I'm on Slack all day. The whole company is on Slack. So how do you...
Airplane mode.
Yeah. And, you know, something I never do, but whenever I do it, it's really awesome, is putting your laptop into airplane mode. You know, turning off Wi-Fi.
Wow, yeah.
I get so much done when I'm offline in planes and really organize things and go deep on things. And just, it's something, I think you might have talked about this, where part of the reason it feels like people are going to meditation is because that's like the opposite extreme of what we're living day to day. And where you used to maybe like stand in line at the elevator or at Starbucks and just kind of be alone with your thoughts, now you're always constantly engaging. In a way that's incredibly compelling and I think ultimately good for the world. But we're still developing like the antibodies to this. You know, we're still figuring out how this technology can and should interact with the rest of our lives for the things that we want to do. And that's actually one thing I really love about working on WordPress and blogging, is like, you know, the most common thing I hear when people are like, oh, you work on blogging, they're like, I want to do that more.
Yes.
You know, versus some other things like people say, well, I wish I spent less time on Facebook or Instagram or something like that. But people really see blogging and publishing as like something that's a positive part of their life. And I believe it is. Both the what you go through mentally to write something and publish something, and then the interactions that you have afterwards. So it's cool to work on something that people feel is like good in their lives.
Yeah, I mean, self-expression, self-reflection, building community around that, no, it's tremendous. Oh, just real quick on the meditation front. The other day, I just went to, my friend hosts this this big quiet, which, you know, 700 people came. It was almost like a concert. There was people online to come meditate. And instead of, you know, instead of alcohol, it was like sweet green salads. I mean, it was crazy. You know, on a Friday night, people come to just get healthy and, you know, be quiet and sit still together.
It's nice to balance that out. Also, for anyone who's listening who thinks I'm like a Zen master, I would say that I struggle so much with meditation right now. It's something that's been on my mind because I'm even worse than I was at the beginning of the year. You know, distractions come and everything like that. So, you know, don't think that there's some sort of like magical people who are really great at this stuff. I would say that it's a struggle for everyone.
Yeah. Cool, Matt. So I know you're tremendously busy. Let me, can you leave us with any plugs where our audience can find your work? And do you have an ask for the product and audience?
Sure, sure. I'm at Photomat on Instagram, Twitter, those sorts of things. I'm on Product Hunt under my name.
Yes.
My blog is ma.tt. It's where I publish, sometimes every day, sometimes sporadically. And yeah, I would say as sort of a plug, you know, I think that Product Hunt's developed a really amazing community of creators and people who build things. And that's exactly the type of people we look for at Automatic. You know, a lot of people who are founders before, freelancers or build things or products. So automatic.com slash work with us. And that's automatic, AutoMatic.com. Check it out. And if what we talked about sounds like an environment you want to be in, I'd love to work with some folks who are listening.
And if you do get hired or reach out as a result of this podcast, let me know because I will feel good because Matt has been very helpful to us. And we want to be helpful back. I remember I first met you at when you were sponsoring the Childish Gambino tour.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was very refreshing to find a successful founder who was also very kind and down to earth. So thank you for doing what you do and also the way you do it.
Oh, of course. Appreciate that.
Cool. Have a great rest of your day and a great weekend, Matt. Thanks for taking the time.